and welcome to the ESVS podcasts. This is Laurence Bertrand, and you are listening to part one of the Q&A series of the recently published first ever ESVS clinical practice guidelines on the management of vascular trauma. Today, we will specifically talk about section two, general considerations in vascular trauma. With me today are Dr. Carl Walgren and Dr. Karim Brohi, the chairs of the guideline writing committee. Dr. Walgren is a vascular surgeon and adjunct professor at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, and Dr. Brohi is a trauma surgeon and the clinical director of the London Major Trauma Network. To both of you, welcome to the ESVS podcast.
We're happy to be here and to present some of the data and the recommendations from these guidelines.
I want to start off talking about who should perform vascular trauma surgery. Recommendation 1, Class 1, Level C, states that rapid access to a clinical team 24/7 competent in hemorrhage control, both open and endovascular surgery, is recommended for the management of patients with life or limb-threatening vascular injuries. Now, how are we to interpret this?
We wanted to state with this first recommendation the importance of controlling bleeding as a first priority, and then, of course, restore circulation, and that requires a broad skill set. We all know that there are different solutions in Europe and worldwide. Many times there is a combined specialties involved in this. Of course, vascular surgery that are really good on hemorrhage control and restoring circulation, but also interventional radiologists, acute and trauma surgeons that are involved in this. But we really want to emphasize the importance for a hospital admitting these patients that they have these broad skill sets 24/7 to take care of these injuries and manage them in the right and correct way.
I think from a system point of view, it doesn't matter who does it as long as it's done well and at the right time and, you know, with a good outcome. I think if you focus on specialties, you focus on the wrong thing, because there are vascular surgeons, Carl said, who are very good at managing hemorrhage, but there are a lot of vascular surgeons who are terrible at managing hemorrhage. And as vascular moves to more endovascular approaches, people are becoming less and less comfortable with open procedures where there's a lot of uncontrolled bleeding around. So I think our point was that somebody in your system has to be able to do this. Somebody has to be there when the patient needs it to do it. And that will vary from hospital to hospital, region to region, and country to country. But it's up to the local, regional, national system to ensure that that person is there.
We are a little bit concerned, just considering that surgery in general becomes more and more elective, and the general surgeons are doing more elective tumor surgery, and the few specialties left, acute chest surgery and vascular surgeries, are doing acute and subacute cases. But surgery in general have been more non-invasive. They do robotic surgery, laparoscopic surgery, and less open. And I think we are coming back to that maybe later in this discussion, how training should be and what to do to make sure that this skill set will exist in hospitals in different parts of the world 24/7. I think that is a challenge. And also within vascular surgery, having a lot of elective vascular surgeons to have these skill sets is also a challenge.
In the earlier recommendation, endovascular surgery is specifically mentioned. Recommendation 3, Class 1, Level C, goes on to add, emergency access to an operating room with hybrid capability is recommended for the operative treatment of the trauma patient with a vascular injury. Does this suggest that vascular specialists should be at the forefront of trauma surgery here, perhaps more so than they have in the past?
So I think what we wanted to highlight with this recommendation, and it's obviously more aspirational than anything else because not everybody has 24/7 hybrid capability. But what's clear from the evidence and the guidelines is that if you are going to present somebody with the best set of options, then you need to be able to deliver both endovascular and open procedures in a timely way, and that actually there are a number of injuries which may be best dealt with by combined approaches. So again, it's not necessarily one person, one specialty doing these. It can be teams of people who are competent in the various aspects of it. So it's much more about having access to the, you know, a contemporary 21st century capability such that you can bring the best things to bear for these patients.
Staying on endovascular for a moment, in the dedicated section 2.5, endovascular therapies for vascular trauma are outlined. However, the lack of evidence is also brought to our attention. Some lesions, such as high-velocity gunshot wounds with injury to the surrounding vessel, as well as stab wounds with unknown levels of contamination around the laceration, pose complex questions as to the safety of choosing endovascular options. What guidance can you give for colleagues finding themselves in these scenarios?
First of all, the evidence base for endo procedures is low, but there's a lot of data showing there's been a rise with improving technical skills and also development of technical solutions within the endovascular fields that it has increased within trauma management. And it's especially useful sometimes as a temporary solution or a bridge to a definitive procedure to use endovascular, because it could be fast in some centers. It's also, you don't need to do maybe an open procedure that can be difficult, especially in more challenging anatomic areas, for example, the thoracic aorta or the subclavian artery. There are also some concerns when doing these procedures about durability and long-term patency. And we know from experience that it's not so good, for example, distally, the extremities, for example, distally of the axillary artery or below the knee that stent. The same in elective vascular surgery, of course, they don't have such good results. But so I think there are some concerns, but it also has helped a lot in some challenging areas.
Yeah, I agree. It's about matching your skill set to what you do. So if you're good at endovascular but not very good at open, and you're presented with a case that you could choose both options, it may be appropriate to choose the endovascular option, even as a temporary measure. The problem, of course, with doing some endovascular is that you don't assess the injury in full. So you don't assess not only just the vessel, but you don't assess the vein. You don't assess any concomitant nerve injury. I think most of the endovascular approaches in the guidelines are recommended as delayed procedures for the new grade two type injury, the pseudoaneurysm, where you're actually treating a potential risk of rupture rather than something that is acutely ruptured or occluded. It's more for the new two type injury rather than the acute occlusion or the active hemorrhage case. But there are always going to be caveats to that.
Moving on to resuscitation principles in vascular trauma, the guidelines state that no research was found focusing specifically on the resuscitation of patients with vascular injury. However, there is a specific recommendation in favor of early administration of tranexamic acid. That is recommendation 5, class 1, level A. Please, could you outline the evidence behind this recommendation and why it was felt necessary to highlight this in the guidelines?
There's pretty strong evidence now for how you should resuscitate a trauma patient, and that includes the use of blood product, the use of tranexamic acid. We didn't find any specific data on the resuscitation of vascular injuries or isolated vascular injury. The reason why we highlighted tranexamic acid is because there's a lot of chatter in the literature, or even just anecdotally, about people saying, well, you shouldn't use tranexamic acid when there's a vascular injury. And what we wanted to highlight, I think, was that there is no evidence to support that view. Now, obviously, tranexamic acid is for bleeding. So if you've got somebody who's got an occlusive injury, then there's no indication for tranexamic acid in that patient. But in a patient who's suspected of hemorrhage and has a shock physiology or obvious active bleeding, there is absolutely nothing to say that that patient wouldn't benefit from tranexamic acid. And that's the rationale for the guideline.
So let's continue with clotting medication for a moment. How would this recommendation in favor of tranexamic acid be combined with the potential need for heparinization? From other non-traumatic massive hemorrhagic shock, such as emergency EVAR for ruptured AAA, the ESVS has recommended to heparinize despite the active bleed. In this guideline, later recommendations, such as number 49 and 94, rather advise considering heparinization on a case-by-case basis, and recommendation 7 specifically advises against heparinization in a tourniquet situation. Why is this different from non-traumatic vascular hemorrhage cases?
So trauma patients, they have an acute traumatic coagulopathy already. And while you obviously want to maintain patency distally and proximally, there's no point giving heparin to somebody who's already completely anticoagulated endogenously, and you're going to make things worse, especially if this isn't their only site of hemorrhage. Essentially, the guidance is, again, if you've got an isolated limb injury that's occluded, you're trawling clot proximally and distally, it's perfectly reasonable to use heparin in that situation. On the other hand, if you've got somebody who's had a big blunt injury, who's got multiple areas of polytrauma, then the leg is not the only thing that you're worried about, and the patient is already probably coagulopathic, and you should temper your use accordingly.
I think also TXA is used in the hemostatic resuscitation early when the patient is bleeding. And at that point, we don't give heparin, of course. It's more when we have an occlusive disease. And I think it's also important to state that this is different entities compared to, for example, ruptured AAA, where you have a localized bleeding. You don't have the trauma in the same way with the tissue trauma and the coagulopathy. We have a coagulopathy also for ruptured AAAs, but I would say it's a bit different. Alluding to the trauma situation, it needs to be individualized at that phase when you do vascular procedures. And for example, with a tourniquet, it's used for external bleeding in the pre-hospital setting in a coagulopathic patient. There is no data supporting that there is a need of heparin at that point. Saying that, of course, it's not good with a tourniquet. It stays for a longer time and it always has to be re-evaluated to be removed as early as possible, especially during long transportation or evacuation, especially in the military setting. Maybe needs to loosen up to restore blood flow. But there is no data out there supporting that there is a need of heparin when you're using that, especially in these coagulopathic patients.
There were anecdotal reports that people were saying that you've got a tourniquet on, you have to give heparin, which makes very little sense underlying it, but somehow this myth seems to have been perpetuated in some areas. So again, the guideline really says that to nip that in the bud, as it were. So, you know, applying a tourniquet is one thing. Use of heparin for a vascular repair is another thing. Use of heparin because you've got a tourniquet on is not a thing at all.
Thank you for clarifying. Next, I'd like to ask about REBOA, the resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta. Although conflicting evidence is quoted, some in favor of REBOA, the final recommendation 8 stated that REBOA is not recommended as a routine approach for temporary hemorrhage control in trauma patients with exsanguinating torso hemorrhage, class 3B, level B. Can you tell us why this is?
So, as you can imagine, this has caused some upset in some areas, as you know, one of the editorials that accompanied the guidelines has shown. But I think fundamentally, guidelines go on evidence, and the evidence is strongest from the UK REBOA randomized control trial, which showed delays to hemorrhage control and increased mortality due to bleeding in people who had REBOA deployed. Now, the people can comment on all sorts of ways on the UK REBOA study, but the fact is that it was a nationwide study of REBOA as currently deployed in, you know, the general trauma center population. And so as a European recommendation, we have to, you know, extrapolate that to say, if you just recommended it blindly across the whole of Europe, you would see the same set of results, that you would increase the amount of bleeding, you would delay hemorrhage control, and you would increase mortality from bleeding. And so the recommendation sits as it stands. Now, there may be pockets of places who are expert in deploying it quickly. There may be you know, specific patients who would benefit, but those can't be identified from the current literature.
So am I correct in understanding that the fear is we would place the REBOA and the back bleeding would continue?
Well, so a lot of patients in UK REBOA didn't get the REBOA deployed. So, you know, there's a decision to make. There's actually getting the stuff out. Then you access the groin in patients who are, you know, in the femoral artery, in patients who are profoundly shocked. All that takes time. That is time that you either may not have, or it may leave people worse further off because of that delay that that has caused. And so in the round at system level, UK REBOA would tell us that people do worse.
Thank you for clarifying. Recommendations 9, 10, and 11 focus on the value and timing of CTA in vascular trauma patients. The focused assessment with sonography in trauma, also known as the FAST test, on the other hand, has not made it into any concrete recommendations in this guideline. Why is that?
Just to clarify a little bit then, so far as FAST is part of the primary survey as an adjunct to identify bleeding, the chest, abdomen, and also see if there is pericardial tamponade. So that still has a place, of course, according to established trauma management, the principles according to ATLS, etc. But FAST is not a good diagnostic modality to identify vascular injuries or retroperitoneal hematomas. And the focus on these guidelines are the vascular injuries. So that's why we didn't have any reason to make any recommendations on FAST.
What we want to do is provide us a clear set of recommendations that everybody could understand and apply. And the clarity that we wanted to bring here is that if somebody needs an operation, they need to go and have an operation. And if somebody needs a diagnostic test, that diagnostic test is a CT angiogram. And it shouldn't be more complicated than that. FAST is an exam for the unstable patient to guide you in where you make your first incision. FAST really has no role in the stable patient. So it's not an either or. It's a different patient who is appropriate for FAST and a different patient who is appropriate for a CT angiogram.
In this guideline, a new arterial injury grading system is presented with corresponding general management recommendations. Can you tell us a bit about this new grading system and why the writing committee felt it was necessary to create one?
This is something new, and we are very proud of coming up with this. And we felt when we were looking at all the different areas of arterial injuries, it was a mix of a lot of small injuries, low-grade injuries, minor injuries, moderate injuries, pseudoaneurysms, severe injuries, and it was difficult to navigate. And we felt we needed a framework for approaching the management of these injuries. And that's how this started. And we have similar grading system for the lung thoracic aortic injuries according to the Society of Vascular Surgery grading system going back more than a decade. We felt that also needed to be updated, and we, by applying these as a general grading system, there are details into this, of course, but it's a general grading system for the arterial injuries that we think makes it a bit easier to guide the management for these injuries.
Yeah, so we wanted to provide some clarity as to not just for vascular surgeons, but for the non-vascular surgeons to understand the thinking behind treatment choices for injuries. And as we did all the reviews, it came out that actually all the algorithms really gravitate to a simple set of decisions, which really fixate on the integrity of the arterial wall. And so the new grading system goes from 1 to 3. In terms of the integrity of the arterial wall, and there's a grade X if the artery is occluded. So, grade one is essentially there's an injury to the arterial wall, but the outer wall is intact on angiogram or even directly visualized. Grade two is there's a disruption to the outer wall, but any bleeding is contained, so i.e., a pseudoaneurysm type picture, or there's an irregularity of the outer wall on CT. And then grade three is a free rupture. And pretty much all the guidelines align to if you've got an arterial wall injury, but it doesn't affect the outer wall, you can just observe those and possibly anticoagulate, give an antiplatelet agent. Something in that's disrupted but contained, you probably does need treatment, but you can probably or almost always do that in a delayed fashion. And then something that obviously has free rupture is going to need emergency surgery and it's probably going to be open. In 99% of cases. And you can apply that to pretty much every single vessel injury around the body with a few caveats. And we hope that that will bring some, make it clear how vascular surgeons are thinking when they make these decisions and also allow people to prioritize along the pathway.
Thank you. Now, I understand that we're looking at this and talking about this system in a very general way for vascular injuries. What is the benefit of delaying treatment for grade two?
Well, so there are benefits to the patient and there are benefits to, logistics and hospital pathways, and there's a reasonable amount of evidence, especially for the thoracic aorta, that delayed intervention is better, surprisingly, providing bleeding is contained.
Do you think that there might be a physiological benefit in a trauma patient grade two to wait a day or two?
I don't think we know the answer to that. I think, the reality is, again, is that we don't have that dichotomy of situations. I don't think we're saying, if you're all teed up and ready to go, you can't treat a pseudoaneurysm straight away, but there is no reason to. And of course, a number of them will have thrombosed by the time you actually get to treat them, especially within solid organs. So I think the point is that, for let's say emergency physicians or something, shouldn't be surprised when people are scheduling procedures for the next morning. If they've got a contained pseudoaneurysm of a vessel, without any worrisome features to it, because it's the appropriate thing to do.
I think also it's important for the priority with other injuries, bleedings in the abdomen, the need to control that traumatic brain injury that is sometimes concomitant with these injuries, that they have better understanding how to prioritize this. I know cases way back where we have done the TVAR first for a pseudoaneurysm and prioritized that higher than some other bleeding sites that, should maybe have a higher priority. So I think that's one of the benefits with the recommendation. It seems that delayed treatment seems more appropriate than doing it in the middle of the night.
Thank you. I'd like to ask about ESVS grade one injury, the ones that present partial wall injuries, such as intimal flaps or intramural hematomas. Which, if any, are strict indications for antithrombotic medication, and which, if any, are strict contraindicated?
I think the data out there is not really, really clear, and there are specific discussion in different anatomic areas, for example, in the carotid areas, for example, or in the extremities. But if there is a risk of compromised distal flow to the end organ, there is an indication for antithrombotic medications in grade one injuries. And it seems that antiplatelet therapy maybe is a little bit better in general than low molecular weight heparin, for example, but still an ongoing discussion. For carotid artery injuries, minimal injuries, grade one injuries, it seems that antiplatelet therapy, for example, is maybe what we recommend. For example, intramural hematoma, where you don't have any compromised flow in the artery, I don't see any indication for antithrombotic medication to treat that. So in one way, it needs to be individualized a little bit, and we still need more data on this, but you need to evaluate if there is any risk for the flow to the end organ and the importance of that.
With all anticoagulant antiplatelet therapy, what you're doing is balancing bleeding risk against thrombosis risk. That's the balance. I think for most trauma patients, the bleeding risk of 3 months or 6 months of antiplatelet therapy is low. And so you can safely put people on it should you feel that that's appropriate. Again, I think we've recommended a single antiplatelet because there's not a lot of evidence to choose one over the other.
Before moving to the end of this episode, I would like to talk about general principles in vascular reconstruction techniques and materials. Recommendation 16, Class 1, Level C, states short interposition grafts are recommended in patients with vascular trauma requiring reconstruction. Is this to be seen as a warning to avoid direct primary suture repair because of the damage to the surrounding vessel that might not immediately be visible, or is this rather a warning against unnecessary bypass surgery where an interposition would also be possible?
No, so I think if you can do a direct primary repair, you should do a direct primary repair. What we're saying is that the shorter the graft, the better, and an inline graft is better than a bypass graft. So, of course, most vascular surgeons are more comfortable doing long bypass grafts, that skirt around injuries. That's where the issue around durability comes in because you've got a long graft in an older patient, underlying disease both proximally and distally, probably, whereas a young patient needs their graft for a long time, but it's only a short graft. So if you can get a short graft in, it probably doesn't matter where it comes from. It's quicker to put a synthetic graft in than harvest a vein. The vein harvest carries a significant morbidity in a number of patients. And then the ultimate advantage with an interposition is that you actually see the injury site, you debride it appropriately. You manage any concomitant vein injury, and you can also assess any parallel nerve that's running there, whether that's injured as well. So, this goes against elective vascular surgery or even emergency vascular surgery for atherosclerotic disease, but it's been pretty standard understood by the trauma literature for quite a long time. And so I think what we wanted to do was really bring that out. And there's a reasonable body of evidence that in circumspect ways supports that approach.
So you mentioned a little bit about this just now, but in terms of graft materials, recommendation 17 and 18, both class 2B, level C, state that while synthetic grafts may be considered for longer conduits or small caliber distal vessels, vein grafts should be considered. So how are we to interpret this? Are synthetic grafts second choice?
So this is an area of discussion, obviously. I think obviously the longer the graft that you put in, the more chance it has of occluding, and the narrower the vessel, the more chance it has of occluding. Often small vessels, especially pediatrics, you don't have the appropriately sized synthetic graft, and so vein is likely to be a better choice. For those cases where you do have to do a long graft, it may be more appropriate to use vein. However, I think if you use vein, you can use vein once. So if you're bypassing an area because there's a lot of tissue damage, you may need to be doing multiple debridements and things, then you may want to be saving your vein for the time when you absolutely do need to use it when you're going to do a definitive repair. So the long bypass graft should really be being conveyed out to history for most trauma patients. And where possible, you should be looking to do short interposition grafts. And we see time benefits and morbidity and potentially temporizing benefits from using a synthetic graft in those indications.
To end this episode, I would like to talk shortly about the challenges in adequate training programs for contemporary trauma surgeons. A recommendation to Class 1 Level C states implementation of civilian and military vascular trauma curricula and dedicated training are recommended for the development and maintenance of vascular trauma decision making and technical skills. In today's surgical training reality, is this an attainable goal, and what can or should be done to achieve such training goals?
Oh, yeah, we really think so. That is an attainable goal. But this, of course, there is a challenge outside high volume trauma centers. There is a need for clinical rotations at these types of centers, but also courses. And I think it's important for every country to have a plan for that. There is possibilities of simulation, live tissue training, cadaveric training in models, but also team-based training. And I think also surgeons and vascular surgeons in general should be involved in disaster training. And this needs to be repeated as well during a lifelong career. I think there's a lot of possibilities to attain these skills and also to keep them for a long time. It needs dedicated training plans for that. And that's why we wanted to highlight that in these recommendations.
Yeah, I think, again, going back to where we start from, obviously not all vascular surgeons, not all general surgeons want to do trauma surgery or want to be called in the middle of the night, and want to deliver this sort of intervention. So it's certainly not something for all necessarily. If you are in a position where you are going to potentially be receiving these patients, then there's a duty to be able to deliver that care, not just on the individual, but on the system to make those training and development opportunities available. What I would say, I think, is, if you can do vascular surgery, then you can do vascular trauma surgery. The only difference is about decision making, really, being comfortable dealing with a field of blood when you start with. But 90% of the difference is decision making. And decision making can be taught by thinking through cases, by case discussion, by looking at and understanding guidelines such as these, and then seeing how they're applied in practice. It's about how do you instill the confidence in people to deliver these interventions as much as, or if more so than the techniques, because any vascular surgeon who's trained should be able to deliver the intervention, really.
Interesting. I mean, presumably, we luckily, I suppose, don't need so many vascular or trauma surgeons that can deliver this level of care all of the time. However, obviously, there are many centers that are receiving patients with these issues. Do you think that there is room for or necessity to have some kind of a subspecialty?
I mean, I think if you look across Europe and the different healthcare systems, different geographies, rural versus urban centers and things, you can't practice a one-size-fits-all solution for those. Wherever you are and wherever you're operating, at some point you may find yourself with somebody in front of you who's dislocated their knee and has got an ischemic leg. And that leg needs to be revascularized within an hour. Doing that is not that hard. And hopefully these guidelines provide some simplicity to that. Recognize that the limb is potentially ischemic. Recognize that you need to rule it out. How am I going to rule it out? I'm going to get a CT angiogram. No discussion. The CT angiogram shows an injury where I'm expecting it to be, where the site of the fracture is. I need to do a short synthetic position graft for that. And that's completely fine. And I'm not going to get criticized for it. And we can see how the leg goes subsequently. That is well within the purview of every trained vascular surgeon. It's what you do every day. It's just being given the license to make those decisions and act on them within the context of your hospital.
Thank you for those insights. That wraps up this interesting discussion and the first Q&A on the new ESVS vascular trauma guideline.
Thank you, Laurence.
Thank you.
Thank you both for joining us today, and thank you everyone out there for listening. We hope to welcome you back for part two soon.